place in Australia I ever came to, and it's certainly one of the most pleasant, so it's a great delight to be back, and I have great memories of being at the House of Freedom and other places last time, so it's good to see you all here today from wherever you come. I'd like to try and share with you some of the tremendous challenges that discipleship is facing today. Now, if I don't make things clear, please just stop me as we go along, unless perhaps you disagree strongly and you want to argue. Let's leave that till the end each time. We'll have plenty of time for discussion. But please raise your hand or raise questions as we go along. There's no point in sort of eyes glazing over and you quietly going off to sleep, you know, if I'm making no sense. Because I really do want to share with you something that's strongly in my heart. And if I don't make sense to you, the whole exercise is totally wasted. Let me begin like this, though. At the time of the Reformation, one of Henry VIII's great doctors read the Bible for the first time in his life, towards the end of his life. Never read it before. Hadn't been given to him. And as he looked at it, he said to himself at the end what became a classic remark, "Either this is not the gospel, or we are not Christians." Now, we're Reformed Protestant Christians. That sort of thing is not a surprise to us. The Reformation was needed because things got so badly out of shape that they were almost upside down in so many areas. This is the 500th anniversary of the birth of Martin Luther. Well, you can think back to scriptures of people like Stephen and the stand he made that was so fresh and revolutionary, or in the Old Testament, kings like Josiah and the Reformation that they had. That sort of thing's not surprising to us. Again and again in the church, we have to realize that we are more sinful, more worldly, more culturally shaped, more culturally short-sighted than we realize. And yet, you know, that is not a great stress today. Look around most of the church today and you see a tremendous stress on renewal. Rightly so, properly so. Renewal, the rediscovery of much of the life of the Spirit, adapting it into all sorts of new and wonderful and worthwhile forms in music and worship and all sorts of things. And there's a tremendous stress today on renewal. But I suggest to you that there isn't that same stress on reformation. I don't mean reformed doctrine, that is sometimes around, but I mean on reformation, on really seeing are the things we're doing and saying shaped by the Scripture, or are we being pressed more than we realize into the shape of the ideas and the world around us, reformation rather than renewal. Of course, both are thoroughly necessary, but one is being talked about tremendously today, and the other is very often being ignored. Now, that is all the more surprising because many people would say that the biggest challenge the church is facing today is one that most Christians haven't even seen. And some people would say this particular challenge is one that is bigger than any challenge the church has faced, say, right back to the Gnostics, even some would say back to the power of Rome. And yet most Christians haven't even seen it. Well, what is the challenge? Well, let me leave the name of the challenge and the description of it on one side for a moment and just give you a couple of simple examples, deliberately extreme, so that you can see what I mean. First of all, a fatuous example, and then a far more fundamental one. First, the fatuous example. Here's an example where evangelical Christians are actually far more profoundly worldly than they themselves are aware. You know that since the 60s, the church has been catapulted out of its sort of generations of being a bit behind the times, and much of the conservative evangelical church is now in the vanguard, and everything new that happens, you almost kind of have a copycat Christianity, a bandwagon believing, that jumps onto it with a Christian expression. Well, in the last 2 or 3 years, what's one of the latest fads? Fitness. Well, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with fitness, but you can see how Christians have copied the fitness fad with Christian terms. And so the first expressions were this, were the movement, quote, "trim for him." Well, if you like that sort of thing, I personally don't, but that's okay. Be fit by all means. Trim for him, maybe. It's a bit cutesy. But then he went along, and then the big best-selling album, and you remember that there was Jazzercise and all the other musical movements by which people started to trim for whoever they wanted to trim for, mostly for themselves. Then came the Christian one. The big-selling album was Firm Believer. Now, wait a minute. firm believer once was a matter of divine faithfulness, and now it's reduced to human fitness. It was once a matter, at least, of sort of apologetics. Now it's a matter of aerobics. But anyway, we hadn't got to the end of the line yet, even of this movement. To me, it climaxed in the slogan for the Christian Fitness Club, "He must increase, but I must decrease." Now, wait a minute again. John the Baptist, for him, that meant losing his head, not shedding a few pounds. And yet, for our modern Christians, that's all it meant. Now, isn't that extraordinary? Ad men and copywriters out in the world delight in using puns. They don't care about the original meaning, so you can have Datsun saves, meaning to do with mileage. They don't care about the original meaning, but they can use puns and they devalue the original meaning and suck out all the meaning out of it. But you see what these Christians were doing? They were actually taking high meaning and emptying it and demeaning themselves, because in profound ways, not only verbally, but in lifestyle, they had become as profoundly worldly as the people at the time of Martin Luther were, in very subtle ways. Now, I say that's a fatuous example because it's so clear. Let me take a far more fundamental one, which isn't so clear, but far more important. Jim mentioned a certain hamburger chain down the road, which you're all invited to go to tea at if you want to afterwards. Well, did you know that the president and founder of McDonald's is a Christian? A few years ago, he was interviewed by the New York Times. They asked him, "In what do you believe?" And he said, "I believe in God, the family, and McDonald's hamburgers." But wait for it. This is the punchline. Then he added, "And when I get to the office, I reverse the order." Now, he was being facetious, I trust. But he was actually being, facetious or not, extremely revealing. Because what he was saying is what millions of Western Christians, not just American, not just British, Australian too, do every day of their lives without realizing it. They get to the public sphere of their lives as economists, as doctors, as attorneys, as hamburger presidents or whatever, and they reverse the order. Now, that is actually the neutralization of the Lordship of Christ in one stroke and a profound form of modern worldliness, and yet millions of Christians do it without ever realizing it. Now, this whole challenge can be summed up in what's called the gravedigger thesis. The gravedigger thesis. You could put it very simply like this. Christianity contributed significantly to the rise of the modern world. Christianity committed itself uncritically and enthusiastically to the world that it helped create. After all, it was number one in that world. Christianity was slowly undermined by that world that it helped to create. So the more uncritical the church is, the more it becomes, you see it, its own gravedigger. Now do you see it? It's not a hostile philosophy. But the very modern world that the church significantly helped to create has undermined the church more effectively, certainly than Rome ever did. It couldn't do it. The church undermined Rome. Even the Gnosticism did for a while. The modern world has done more damage to the church in the last 200 years than any enemy or opposition that the Christian world has had in 2,000 years of Christian history, and most Christians don't even know it. That's the damage. And that's what I'd like to speak about. Now, before we get into this, and you'll see why my book is called The Gravedigger File, it's written up more imaginatively than this because you can't talk to the average church member about the sort of things we're going to get into this afternoon. Their eyes would glaze over long before any of yours do on a Saturday afternoon, so I've used a particular technique to try and make it more interesting. But let's examine this tough challenge of the gravedigger thesis to see what it means for our discipleship. But first, let's begin with a couple of introductory questions. One, what's the purpose of this sort of cultural analysis? Now, a good many of you have been to university or wherever. You know there's a time and a place for hard academic thinking for its own sake in certain areas. That is not our concern this afternoon. We know, incidentally, that there are dangers in that. There are many Christians who have gone into philosophy or into psychology or into sociology and, frankly, haven't practically emerged. In other words, at the end of 10 years, you know which discipline they're talking about, but you can hardly tell whose disciple they are. Our concern is the disciples' concern this afternoon. Make no mistake, we'll dip into things that are heavily sociological, for example. But I'm only interested in them to throw light on discipleship. Why? The great philosophical strength of Christianity lies in its claim to be true. It has a tough claim to be true. But do you realize what the great cultural, sociological strength of Christianity lies in? It lies in its challenge to tension. Tension. Did you know the root meaning of the Hebrew word faith is actually tension or tautness, like a rope being stretched to the breaking point? Why? Because faith and obedience are holding down certain parts of our lives and the world for Christ in a world which rejects him. And so it's inevitably tension. And we're called to have two types of tension. We're to be in the world, but not of the world. That is the spatial tension, in but not of. And we're also no longer what we used to be before we came to Christ, but we're not yet what we will be when Jesus comes again. So you have the time tension. So our faith is a matter of obedience, in but not of. No longer, but not yet. And when the church is faithful, faithfulness to Christ means inevitably foreignness to the world. So that we are committed to the world, yes, but we're never compromised by it, however much we live in it, and so on. Now, Jesus alone did this well. The friend of publicans and sinners, of glutton and the winebibber, etc. And yet he showed his Father's purity and his love and his holiness wherever he went with these people. Now, he alone did it perfectly. But the church is always at its best when it shows that tension of in but not of, which simply means that we have got to examine the world of our time. We have got to examine the spirit of our own age. We have got to examine the pressures in the town we live in, the culture we live in, the subculture we come from. And if we don't, we will slowly be shaped by them so that we'll be not transformed by the renewing of our minds, as Paul says in Romans 12, but conform to the image of the world around us. So, please don't misunderstand any of this. Why are we doing this? Why are we picking up horrible sociological words that have Z-A-T-I-O at the end? Not for any academic sake. We're not sort of pseudo-intellectuals who want to show that Christians can be free or whatever. We're only interested in this because we want to be faithful to our Lord, clearly in a world where the pressures will mold us unless we're aware of them. Do you know in America who the most worldly Christians are? They're the sort of types of people who will be shocked to think about the things we're thinking about this afternoon. And that's one of the strongest reasons why they are so worldly. The funny thing in the last 10 years is that it is the fundamentalists in America who have become the most worldly. In claiming to be world-denying but not understanding the world, they have become the most worldly without realizing it, even more worldly than the liberals of whom they're afraid and whom they often despise. And we'll see why as we go on. So there's the first question. Why are we doing it? To seek to be faithful as disciples. Second question. Why are we Christians often so poor at this? Let me give you a couple of reasons for this among many. The first is this. Many Christians, particularly conservative Christians, have no feel for the social dimension of believing. It's tough enough just to believe in our world today. Go to a philosophy department, a psychology department, and your faith is attacked or slowly undermined or patronized. A lot of Christians hang on at the end. They just believe, and all they can do is just believe. And usually those Christians who want to understand why they believe and explore belief usually are more apologetically, philosophically, theoretically inclined. They know why they believe what they believe and can give philosophical answers, and that's important. But very few Christians understand the social dimension of belief. And often, for that reason, they don't pick up the sort of things we're going to look at this afternoon. In other words, we're not looking at how Freud or Marx or A.J. Ayer attacked the faith, because that actually doesn't affect the ordinary people at all. We're looking at the shape of our ordinary world and how that affects them. Car driving, television watching, being members of this group or working in that factory or that bureaucracy. Those sort of things. In other words, the social dimension of believing. And people who have a purely apologetic idea, it's all theory, all philosophy, they just don't pick up that. Let me put it like this. If the world weren't fallen, there'd only be one reason for believing and one reason for disbelieving. You would only believe what was true, and you'd only disbelieve what was false. But of course, the world has fallen. You don't have to be a cynic to look around our world to see that people can often disbelieve what is incontrovertibly true, such as the gospel, but not only the gospel. And many people can believe what is patently nonsense. Why? There are other reasons than it simply being true or false. I could put it another way. We'll use the word credibility for what is actually true or not. Then let's add another word in. In other words, something is credible according to whether it is true or not. If it's untrue, it's incredible. If it is true, it's credible. And that's a matter of whether it's objectively, literally, really true or not. Do you get it? But there are other reasons why people believe, quite apart from a truth's credibility. And the other reason is its plausibility, whether or not thing seems to be true or not. And that isn't a matter of the mind or truth at all. That's a matter of the social dimensions of believing. Studies have shown, for instance, that it's very difficult for anyone to believe by themselves. It takes a very strong-minded person, or a genius, or, sadly, a madman, to believe something all by themselves. Why? Because even if you believe the truth, it is, quote, easier to believe if you have other people talking the same language, sharing the same universe, practicing the same values, which all come out of it. In other words, there is a community of belief. There is a support structure of belief. Now, put that in reverse. If there are enough people who all believe the same thing, they can believe absolute nonsense very easily. If they have enough of a community, a support structure, and so on. In other words, even the truth needs to be fleshed out, modeled, and demonstrated to be a community of belief for social reasons, quite apart from philosophical, intellectual reasons. For instance, in the 60s, many people moved from the Midwest United States, you know, as uptight as any part of Australia you'd like to be, if you view that sort of conservative mentality of the middle class as uptight, as many people did. But in the 60s, many people moved from, say, the Midwest to Greenwich Village, you know, New York bohemian life. In 3 weeks, they'd become bohemians, without any understanding that they had been virtually converted from a middle-class stance to a totally sort of radical stance, lifestyle-wise, converted in commerce. Why? Because they're just a whole world. And passing through one world to another world, it's almost like going through a magic retort, they changed. Do you know, in the late 60s at Le Brie, when the community was most speaking the truth in love and showing the truth, we often had to tell people, don't become Christians just because of what you've seen at Le Brie. Please, please, please don't. I'm afraid you're making almost a leap of faith because you're attracted to the community. You've never seen a whole Christian community modeling truth and expressing love. Go away for 3 weeks. Think about it in the world which denies it, but by yourself for a while, and then decide, because we want you to decide whether or not it's true. In other words, the social dimension was so powerful that to many of them it almost overpowered. Now you see, this afternoon we're going to look at some of the worst ways the church is being shaped. And the simple lesson is that often, despite what we say, what we show is so much a contradiction of what we say, they go in two different directions. And what we say, I mean we as Christians in the whole world, what we say is contradicted by what we show, and they realize it, but we don't, because we have no feel for the social dimension of believing. Are you with me? And often Christians who lack that feel, I'm sure some of you here from the communities and so on, you have that feel. But many Christians don't, and we need to get them to see what the New Testament says about it. For example, the New Testament doesn't talk about plausibility and that sort of support structure, but the idea is there. For example, 1 Timothy 3:15. Paul actually refers to the church as the pillar and bulwark of the truth. He doesn't say, because the church is strong, Christianity is true. That would be nonsense. Christianity would be true if the church was completely decadent and wiped out even through unfaithfulness. Christianity would be true if no one was there to believe it, if God is there. But Christianity being true, the church is the bulwark and pillar of the truth. Christianity is true, the church is the pillar of the truth by demonstrating it, fleshing it out. You have the same idea in the words of Jesus. It's as we love each other, but that they will know we're his disciples, etc. In other words, it's the plausibility, the support community that models and demonstrates and fleshes out the truth. And unless that's there, what we say will be contradicted by what we show. But many Christians have no feel for that sort of social dimension of the truth. The second reason is this. Many Christians have no tool to pick up these sort of things. Look around the Christian world today. Most Christians don't analyze the world at all. Now that's odd enough in itself. Take, say, our American fundamentalist. He may be very close to the Australian or British fundamentalist, for all I know. Now, our American fundamentalist, he's very close to the British one, I do know that, but I'll leave you to judge about your Australian ones. Now, the British fundamentalist, let me be English for a moment. He has in his theological repertoire the concept of the world, the flesh, and the devil. Rightly so. He who loves the world is an enemy of God. It's quite clear in Scripture. We should have a very high view of worldliness. But you'd think because of that we would analyze the world. There's the irony. Even those who have a high view of, quote, worldliness often have a low view of it in practice. It's reduced to things which by biblical standards are trivial, and they don't pick up the spirit of the age, the structures of the world, which are the ones really shaping them, not just in the fact that someone goes to this film or whatever, but actually shaping them, their whole lifestyle, so that those who even talk about the world, and most Christians don't, are more sophisticated evangelicals, for instance, in England, they don't even have a concept of worldliness at all. So let's not laugh at the fundamentalists. They at least have a concept, but often they reduce it to trivial things. And many of the young evangelicals, their parents had it, but they've kicked off, you know, those old-fashioned things. They have no concept of the worldliness at all. And because of that, they have no tool either to analyze the way the world is shaping them. Now, some people do analyze the world. But I would say to you, of those who do, and I imagine most of you do here today, it's interesting, and I don't know Australia, but moving around the rest of the English-speaking world, which I know much better, most of those who analyze the world use the one of the two tools which is the less useful. In other words, the most commonly used tool in Christian circles, if you want to analyze what's going on in the world, is the history of ideas. History of ideas is very important, very, very important, but it just doesn't pick up the sort of things we're talking about this afternoon, which raise the biggest problem. In other words, the history of ideas analyzes philosophers or psychologists, you name it, Nietzsche, Hegel, Kierkegaard, Marx, Freud, and shows how their ideas have come from ivory towers or whatever, studies, and have slowly filtered, washed down in the rain until even your cab driver in Brisbane or fish and chip seller in the East End of London actually saying things that come from Freud and these others, and he doesn't realize it, but the ideas are there in his head. And that's very important to understand, but doesn't pick up the sort of things I'm saying. The whole pressures of modernization which have shaped them. There's a second tool, not the history of ideas, but a tool, the very word's enough to put people off, so I won't use it for the moment, but which doesn't look at ideas, which just says, I'll look at people's ordinary experience. And I'll see how the world of their ordinary experience, the background world in which they live, has shaped their thinking. So you see, the history of ideas moves from the thoughts to the world. This other approach moves from the ordinary world back to the thinking and believing. The history of ideas starts with very sophisticated ideas that have been argued about and discussed and are really proven to be academically tough and so on. The other approach says, who cares about that? If anyone believes it, that's what matters. So your cab driver may have the oddest ideas. Fish and chip seller may be into the weirdest things, the housewife's ideas, the child's ideas, the philosopher, who cares why they believe it? That doesn't matter. The fact is, what do they believe? And what in their ordinary experience has shaped it? Now, let me give you an example. Looking a bit glazed at this point. It is, after all, Saturday afternoon. Let me give you an example so you can see the difference between the two. Take, say, our Western view of time. If I was to ask you, put forward your brightest person in the room, House of Freedom, Teen Challenge, Youth for Christ, AFES, whatever you are, you know, SU, put forward your brightest person in the room and describe what has shaped our Western view of time, our Western modern view of time. All right, we'll take our AFES person, well-trained and so on, out he'd come, no doubt, and probably do a brilliant job. He'd show how the modern view of time is shaped by the Bible, which it is, Augustine, which it is, many people down through Einstein and so on, which they are. Now, how many of you could do that? But even if they did that, that would only be half the story. Because actually, the real shaping factors in our modern view of time are not only those, but things like this. Clocks, watches, diaries, timetables, schedules, calendars, and so on. And those have actually shaped most modern people because they're in the world all around them. Far, far more. Let me give you an illustration. You'll see why Filipinos refer today to Westerners as people with gods on their wrists. You want to see where the Westerner really has instant obedience? It's not when he reads the Bible. It's when he looks at his watch, shoots off somewhere. Let me give you this illustration, though. Far more important. Any of you ever seen Millet's painting, The Angelus? Two peasants bowing in the field and praying as the bells ring out. You seen the painting? Millet didn't paint it for this reason, but it's interesting because you look at that and what you're seeing is Christian time of worship breaking into work time. So that in the fields, while they go about their work, they're stopping actually to pray. Christian time actually interrupts work time. Now, come with me down 150 years later to Los Angeles. We'll take all these American examples because they haven't touched us, of course. But you look around for the Australian culture, and I'm just taking them because I'm English and you're Australian. We can all see the Americans easily. I'm not anti-American. My wife's American. Please don't misunderstand me. It's just that it's far easier to see things there than here. But then you've got to look back and see them here too. I was in a church in Los Angeles 3 months last year. Very intrigued. Every single Sunday, whichever service I went to, the early, the middle, or the late, exactly on the hour, there was a chorus of digital alarms went off. Beep, 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 beep. And immediately the sermon finished, the hymns were sung, the whole thing was finished, the car park was cleared, or they rushed home for lunch, or whatever. I was most intrigued. There was absolutely no chance to get, quote, in Wesley's words, lost in wonder, love, and praise. No chance at all. The service was run like a sort of Swiss railway timetable. But you see what had happened? You see how the Angelus and the Angelinos were light years apart? Because simply of this. The real world's time was what set the time for worship. Now, again, you say it's a trivial illustration. But you see the difference. If you understood only the history of ideas, you'd never understand that. Or only half understand it. It takes far more simple things in the real world around to really see how they've been shaped. Okay, but many Christians have either no feel for that, or secondly, no tool to pick it up. So you're all with me. What we're looking at is the gravedigger challenge. Christianity contributes to a world which undermines it, so the church becomes its own gravedigger. And those are the introductory questions. Let's move on faster to the three main questions in this first session. First, what are the processes of modernization that are doing this? What on earth is it that is having this impact on the church? Secondly, what are the pressures within all that which most affect religion? Not just the Christian faith, but all religions. And we'll stop there in the first section. Then the second session, we'll go on to ask the more important question, what are the problems this is creating for the church? In the third session, this evening, we'll go and look at something of a Christian response to this and how we work back and break out of the various problems it's created. But you see where we're going. The first question then, very fast. This is the simplest, the least important. It's the most obvious. What are the processes of modernization we're talking about? Well, just think for a moment. If I just say to you, what does it mean to you to be a modern Australian compared to the first Australians who landed? If you just to think for 20 seconds of all the things that are different because you're modern. I don't know what you're thinking of. probably everything from cars, telephones, computers, satellites, video games, you name it. Whole constellation of things that made our world entirely different, and we love it, most of it. Now, that's roughly what I'm thinking of. Although, to be more technical for a few seconds, those things themselves are rooted in three basic carriers, in the medical sense of carriers. Things which, when they go, carry the disease of modernization as well, though it's not only a disease, of course. Carriers. What are the three? Well, first, technological innovation through the Industrial Revolution. Secondly, the capitalist market economy. And thirdly, streamlined bureaucratic organization. Where those three go, modernization goes, starting in France and England and so on, spreading right throughout the world. You can see it's hardly a part of the world that today is not touched. Well, very simply, that's roughly what I mean. We'll leave that one at the simplest level. You know, you hardly need to expand that. Most of you arrived here in cars. You used your telephones. You are willy-nilly modern people. You may reject cars, some of you on bicycles. I imagine here and there you're making your own particular protests against it, but almost willy-nilly you're modern people, certainly by comparison with the Aboriginals in certain parts of Australia. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Let's move on to the second question. That's the important one. What are the pressures in all that? Computers don't look too anti-religious. Nothing leaps out of a video game against us. What are the pressures within all that that bear down on religion and crucially affect it? Now let me mention the three pressures which most analysts see, and I'll use the technical terms. I'll define them and explain them. Once you've got the idea, if you don't like the term, I don't like them myself, drop them. Okay? The important point is not to go around using new buzzwords. Some of you use these anyway. But not if you don't, not to go around using used words, but to get the idea and see where it affects discipleship. Okay? So please don't misunderstand this either. But these are the three terms. First, secularization. Secondly, privatization. And thirdly, pluralization. Let me define what I mean. Firstly, secularization. Are any of you in the social sciences here? One. Forgive me for making this a bit simple, but most of you aren't. Secularization. This is what I mean by it. By secularization, I mean the process by which the modern world has neutralized religion in the central sectors of society. Has neutralized religion in the central sectors of society. What do I mean by the central sectors? I mean the areas like science, technology, economics, most business, much of politics, etc. Very loosely, the world of work. In the highly developed, modernized way. Secularization is the process by which modernization has neutralized religion in the central sectors of society. Put simply, in the modern world, religious institutions, for example the church, are now marginal. They're out on the fringes. Religious ideas are now less meaningful. People may be religious going into that world, but the world is not run on those religious ideas, whatever they are. This is secularization. Now, let me be very clear at this point. Secularization is not secularism. Secularism is a philosophy, such as Marx's or Freud's. In other words, a philosophy which believes explicitly that there is no God or supernatural, invisible, or whatever. That is secularism. But secularization is not a philosophy, it's a process. It's something which has actually happened. It's not rooted in ideas. It's rooted in the institutions and the shape and the structures of our society. And the question is, what has happened and why, and what's it done to the faith above all? Now, to all religions, of course, at this point, but to the faith above all. Well, you remember in the past how there were very few skeptics in society. I mean, pre-traditional society, 1750 or earlier. Almost everybody was open to a world where there were experiences beyond what they could see and touch and taste and hear and so on. Not only that, this ordinary world was understood in the light of the other world, whatever it was, timeless dream world that the Aborigines had or the Christian understanding of it. The other world was actually more real than this world, but you realize for the secularist, the ordinary reality is not only the official reality in the sense that most philosophers and so on believe in it, it is for most modern people most of the time, and for some people all the time, it is the only reality. And that's the result of secularization. Now, what's done that? Let me mention two simple factors, which if you can see, well, they're not simple, really, but you can cotton on to them, you can see how many of us are more secularized than we realize. I'll just use four words to get the two. First, there's been a movement of explosive diversification. Explosive diversification. Let me explain this carefully. The words themselves don't give you any clue. Think of a picture. Have you ever seen a silhouette of a European capital 1750 or earlier? You can just see the social and spiritual power of the church in the architecture. Huge abbeys and cathedrals, steeples and spires thrusting up. Look at them today. Insurance blocks, banks, you name it. And the churches crouched, dwarfed, and so on. That's just an architectural picture of what's happened in the Industrial Revolution and beyond. An explosive, volcanic eruption of institutions, industry, and all these separate... But you see what's happened? Each is now a separate world with a separate way of doing things. And so religion is irrelevant to that world because each world is independent and autonomous because of this explosive diversification. And instead of religion presiding over the whole of life and the Christian participating in all of these things as a Christian, now the church is just displaced to the sides. And just as Christians, the churches crouch down, so Christians just go in with their faith in their pocket and almost hang it up at the door as they go in invisibly. Well, let me give you another illustration. Just a picture. Between 1860 and 1900 in Paris, church growth grew 33%. 40 years, 33%. Have you grown that fast in Australia in the last few years? By no means. But wait a minute. Paris grew 100%. Do you get it? That was dynamic church growth the late Victorians had, even in the Catholic world, let alone the evangelical world and the Protestant world. Dynamic church growth. But it was completely outstripped by the growth of the modern world, so that Christians were more than 70% behind, despite 30% church growth. Do you see it? Explosive diversification. The result? Displacement. Christians couldn't catch up. The working class, for instance, since then, has almost been left out of a Christian concern and presence very often. The world of work has largely been left out. So whole sections of the population, whole sectors of life have been left out because, you see it, explosive diversification, so the central sectors have been neutralized. Are you with me? Take the second factor. Extensive rationalization. Extensive rationalization. Now, this is the reason, the creeping hand of reason, but not the reason of the philosopher. This is not rationalism, but the reason of the engineer. Only let me figure it out, says the engineer, and everything can be made. You see, more and more of life, after the Industrial Revolution, etc., is classified, calculated, controlled. It's reduced to reasonable ways of doing things. Now, of course, this is marvelous. Don't misunderstand me. Take, say, the moon landing. You see it brilliantly. Seen one way, the moon landing is awesome. 1969 and so on. Another way, it's just the same way we'd market a perfume or promote a political leader or whatever. What do? You just figure out everything that's involved, a whole assembly of procedures and plans and so on and so on and so on to get these men to the moon so that, quote, nothing is left to chance. But don't you see, when, quote, nothing is left to chance, certainly nothing's left to spontaneity. You don't want any spacemen clowning around on the moon. They are carefully trained scientists. Nothing is left to chance or spontaneity or, wait, any spiritual or supernatural intervention either. In other words, the more of life that's under the spreading hand of reason, this extensive rationalization, the less and less of life has any part for the other. Do you see it? As Jacques Ellul puts it, medieval Christians could say, I applied the medicine and God brought the cure. But you'd never think of driving your car and saying, I put my foot on the gas or the accelerator, whatever you say over here, and God made the car go faster. That's ridiculous. But we all know what happens in between our putting our foot down and the car going faster. And once we know what's all, there's no mystery or magic about it. There's nothing particular bending about it except thoroughly rational, technological, etc. But you see, that sort of mentality has spread more and more in certain sectors of society, so that it's not that religion's unwanted, but religion is just impractical and quite irrelevant. So the Christian is there in the central sectors, but his religion is not what operates, because the central sectors is a different world with different ways. You got it? There's secularization. And there's the explanation, of course. You see what happens, I'm not applying at this point, we'll do that in the next session. But just look at discipleship. There's the explanation of McDonald's. I believe in God, the family, and McDonald's hamburgers, and when I get to the office, I reverse the order. It's a different world with different ways. And millions of other Christians and most evangelicals, when they work in the public world, do that without realizing it almost every day. You see how that affects worship? Now, you see, worship isn't in the central sector, so it's affected in one of two ways. The first way is those who are more affected even in the private sphere than they realize, so the central sector mentality comes back with them, like my digital alarms. They're never lost in wonder, love, and praise. Often, though, other people's worship is almost a compensation. The underwhelming sense of transcendence in the central sectors of society creates a passionate hunger for it elsewhere, which, of course, leads to genuine desire for renewal and also for many counterfeit forms of it, too. And so you see, secularization produces new religious impulses in very powerful ways. Okay, you've got the first one. On to the second and third, which are much easier to understand. It's the first, but it's the toughest, and also the most elusive. The second one is privatization. The simplest way of saying it is it's just the flip side of this. Privatization is the process by which the modern world creates a huge gulf between the private spheres of our life and the public spheres of our life. Now, don't misunderstand me. People always had a difference between their private world and their public world to some extent, but it's never as big as today. Of course, the more modern the world, the bigger the gap. And that's true of everything I say today. The more modern the world, the more this will apply. If you're a missionary to the Aboriginals, almost nothing of what I say will apply to you if you're living out there. Equally, if you live in a little village somewhere in the world, it doesn't apply so much as if it does, say, in the most modernized parts of Sydney or Wollongong or wherever. All right, privatization. Just think of someone who works in a government office or an industrial factory or whatever. They are not most free in their public work lives. What they want to say, what they want to wear, etc., what they want to do, that isn't the world they're most free and most fulfilled. Far from it. Many of them are just a number, or they wear a uniform, it may be pinstripe, and so on. The limits of their freedom and fulfillment are very small. To many people, the public world, the bureaucracy or whatever, say the Pentagon or General Motors, is a big, anonymous, alien, incomprehensive world where they earn their bread and so on, and they're glad to get out of it. But where are they most themselves? In the private world. We get home 5 o'clock or whatever it is, and we get out of these things, fling off the suit and get into our own thing. And here is a world in the Seeker song, where a world of our own. Do what we like. Now, don't misunderstand me. This isn't totally bad. It's partly good. We have amazing freedom in the private world. Amazing freedom compared to the past or, say, the Soviet Union. But do you see that for all the freedom, do you see what it does to faith? Because privatization, among many things, restricts faith to the private world only. Secularization knocks it out of the public. Privatization restricts it to the private. So that faith today flourishes in the private world. The non-work world of leisure, the weekend, the weeknight, the world of home. The church is doing well there, but it's doing well only there. Now, do you see some of the snags of that? The first snag is clearly that the privatization is limited and limiting. Do what you like in the private world, but only in the private world, as long as you don't upset the apple carts in the public. So, you good people, you want to have your prayer breakfast before work or your Bible studies? By all means, do. But when you get in there at 9 o'clock, you get down to work as everyone else. Or our east-west set down the road, maybe they want to have TM and a bit of meditation and lunch hour. By all means, do, especially if it makes them happier and more complacent afterwards. But when they get back at 2 o'clock, they better get down to work the same way as everyone. You see it? By all means, all these things, whatever that makes anyone free and happy and so on, that has nothing to do with the public world. Now, doesn't that make us put a question mark over much of so-called renewal? The problem with it is not where it begins, but that it ends there too. And that's different from renewal in the past. 150 years ago, you know, one of our British prime ministers heard an evangelistic sermon. He was furious. He made what became a classic remark. He said, "Things have come to a pretty pass if I'm expected to take Christianity seriously in my personal life." He was prepared to have a formal state church, but something that changed him personally made him furious. Why? Because he saw that if it changed him from the inside, it went the whole way out. And for a prime minister in the days of the empire, that was some going, as Wilberforce and others knew. But you see, he wasn't wrong. He was right. 10 years ago, an observer went round many American churches, including the renewal ones, and he made this remark that's always stuck in my mind. Christianity today is socially irrelevant if privately engaging. Socially irrelevant if privately engaging. Now, that's the generalization. It doesn't cover everybody, thank God. But could there be any more damning comment on the modern expressions of the Lordship of Christ? We are the community whose ancestors blew apart the Roman Empire because the Lordship of Christ took on Caesar himself, because Christ was Lord of absolutely everything, or he's Lord of nothing. And yet, thinking that we're all reformed and renewed, etc. today, millions of us operate in a way which is a living denial of all that we say. So one of the theme tunes of the 70s is "He is Lord," and so on. And yet many Christians have sung that faithfully and believe it passionately, haven't realized how the structures of the modern world, as insidious and invisible as Gnosticism as a philosophy was earlier, has shaped them so that they're socially irrelevant, although privately engaging. The problem with much of what we have is not that it's wrong where it starts, it's great where it starts, but it stops there too. Now, there are other problems. I'll just mention one. Privatization is extremely fragile and volatile. You can see it in marriage. In the old days, for instance, there were other things like the extended family. They hold marriages together, quite apart from principles. But in a privatized world, the basic unit is just the nuclear family. Fragility. So, who's interested in history? Who's interested in the denominations? Who's interested in the established church? Who's interested in the formal? Who wants doctrine? Who wants the local church and the old uptight structures? We're for freedom and caring and the personal and for spirituality and you name it. You know, we've all heard it in the 70s. It's all around us. Wait a minute. Fantastic, this movement. Yes, renewal. Ah, but one minute, they've grown up overnight. Deep, caring, sympathetic house churches. 10 years later, where are they? They have all the stamina of a mushroom. Because they do not have the biblical structures underlying them. They are as much molded by privatization as they are by theology. And they're here today and gone tomorrow. And incidentally, one can see many of the communities are the same. So you can look around Australia and see that many of the Christian communities in the 70s, not realizing the sociological pressures which created them, have actually over 10, 15 years destroyed them too, because there was as much starry-eyed idealism as there was hard biblical theology and commitment to them, although they spoke of things that looked thoroughly biblical on the surface. And they've run against the rocks of the reality of the structures of our modern world. You getting it? Privatization. The third one, the last one, I'll stop after this, pluralization. Pluralization, this is the simplest to understand. Pluralization is the process by which our modern world increases the options we all have on all sorts of trivial levels, but especially at the level of faiths and worldviews. Now, secularization is almost unique in human history. It is a new thing in some ways. There have been skeptics and secularists before, but not secularization on our modern scale. Pluralization, though, isn't unique, and it's not new. Anyone think of a previous age that was as pluralized almost as ours? Yeah, first century. In other words, the church has no problems with pluralization or pluralism. Or let me put it more clearly. The church once had no problems with pluralism. Sadly, having grown out of a pluralistic climate And after all, when the Greek and Roman gods collapsed, there was an explosion of mystery religions, cults, esoteric this and mystery that. That's the world in which the gospel was born, and the church had no problem with that at all. Christ was exclusively Lord and God. Christian truth was absolutely true. And so in a relativistic climate, they were unfazed. But we've been a monopoly for so long. We've forgotten that. And now this new pluralization is so strong that we're affected by it, and the church is actually being affected, liberal and conservative, under the impact of pluralization, much, much more than it realizes. Now, you don't have to figure out the sort of things that have caused it. There are religious factors, let me leave those, but just think of the modern factors that increase the sense of choice and change. You suggest a few. Travel, fabulous one. I mean, here you, I've met Australia, I've traveled to India and all those sort of places doing research, and everywhere you go, there are Australians visiting these places with packs in their backs and so on. So through travel, whether that way or, you know, sort of more comfortable ways, you know, we've seen these worlds, and they're all of it. What other sort of things? Media. You don't have to travel. The world comes to us. Yeah. Come on. Education. The knowledge explosion since the 19th century. We're aware of more people and more pasts and what others are into than was undreamed of in previous generations. Part of the whole, yeah? Simplest of all, in some ways, is just money. You know, we have the time to travel, we have the time to buy, educate, and so on and so on. Anyway, you can think, it's obvious. In other words, we are aware of the presence of others as never before in human history. But you see, each time, even unconsciously, we're aware of the presence of others. You want to eat out tonight? I don't know, Brisbane, but can you eat out Chinese, Indonesian, Malay, all these choices? Just so you're in 2 miles and you have all sorts of ethnic varieties of foods. Now, that's just cuisine. Move up to customs and move up to convictions. And they're all there. But you see, the presence of others means possibilities for ourselves. I don't have to eat stodgy old English Yorkshire roast, you know, whatever. I can eat out all these exotic things, but I don't even have to believe whatever I used to believe. And now I can buy a reincarnation or whatever. Anyway, go on. You see the point. Here's the sting. The more choice, the more change, the less continuity, the less commitment. That is the sting of pluralization. The more choice, the more change, the less continuity, the less commitment. And that's the sting and the way it affects Christians. Let me illustrate that like this. I don't have it, but if I had my great-grandfather's silk Victorian handkerchief around my neck in my pocket, if I lost it, I would really look for it. The old, valued, beautiful, family, you could say I would be deeply attached to it. Now, have you ever seen a modern person feverishly hunting for a lost Kleenex tissue? It would be ludicrous. I mean, after all, disposability is the essence of a Kleenex. But you see, because of pluralization, we relate to things in the modern world today more like Kleenex tissues than the silk handkerchief. The more choice, the more change, the less commitment, the less continuity. Now, forget Kleenexes. Move up more seriously. Take, say, relationships. The average Londoner meets as many people in 1 week as a medieval person would meet in a lifetime. So apart from just a few, he runs through the rest fast, superficially, and functionally. A person who puts petrol or whatever into his car, so on. You see how that affects marriage? You can see why people like Claire Booth Lewis and others say that it's humanly right today. You need at least 3 husbands or wives in one's life because different periods of life, different partners of life. It's ridiculous to think of one man, one woman, and all a changing midlife crisis. But actually, pluralization has affected relationships and marriage just as much as permissiveness and lack of morals. And you can see that at the level of Christian leadership. And the unfaithfulness to wives as Christian leaders travel around the world and so on. And divorce at that level is quite appalling, outstripping the world even. Not because of their lack of morals, they've got it, but because of the high degree of pluralization in their relationships, which leads them into unfaithfulness. But move on to the highest level of all, faiths. Do you realize that modern people run through faiths like Kleenex tissues? Some people have been into 10 trips in as many years. And the impact is on all sorts of levels. For instance, it increases relativism. Everything now is just relative to your background, your tradition, your culture, and so on. The sense of relativism in our culture is so enormous that tolerance just slips over into permissiveness. People are unwilling to stand for truth. Or if they do, it's so uptight because they're threatened by all the other differences that they're dogmatic and defensive and belligerent. And the old way of being clear about truth, respecting someone else but disagreeing with them, is increasingly disappearing. Or take a second factor, self-consciousness. We're aware constantly of all those others and of where they've come from, what they might think, and offending them, and so on and so on. So there's a terrific self-consciousness about modern faith that would never have been there in the past. Or take another factor, what's called conversion proneness. In the old days, conversion meant everything. It was a total change, but that wasn't a surprise. It was once for all, and it was meant to last a lifetime. But people are in and out of things today. Do you know, in the States, even in the church, you can almost say, and studies have shown this, that even Christians are just born again and again and again and again and again. And the testimonies of their new experiences and so on really just are a kind of spiritual visiting card of the latest fashion they got into this year and so on and so on. Because of this conversion proneness. And it's pointed out today, modern man is converted too easily and yet does never stick. Things are picked up easily and they're dropped easily. You see, the ultimate thing that pluralization touches is commitment. Put simply, pluralization is like Teflon. In the old days, commitment and faith stuck together like the egg in the frying pan. But pluralization is kind of like an invisible miracle coating. And no longer, not just Christians, others are sort of bounce off now easily. And you can see this appalling lack of commitment, certainly in the church, but right across the board, in many, many ways because of pluralization at profound levels. All right, enough there for this first session. Put those together. Secularization knocks faith out of the center and makes each faith less real, inevitably. Privatization restricts each faith to the private world and makes each, inevitably, merely a private preference to the outsider anyway. So that, oh, he's into opera, particularly the Great Opera House in Sydney or whatever. He's into golf. Oh, he's into charismatic Bible studies or into Christian communities. No. Everyone's into something and they're into religion. Merely a private preference. Pluralization makes each faith just one among many. A huge, completing, smorgasbord of options. And some people just shrug their shoulders and don't want anything. Now put those together. And you see what creates a gigantic sort of pressure cooker on faith. And that's the result of modernization. Secularization, privatization, pluralization. And then we'll go on further to pick up the question in the next session. What's this done to the church and the problems this has created? Let's leave it there and have some time for discussion each time. Yeah. No, his question is, in what way has Christianity been responsible for the rise of the modern world? It hasn't in any way been responsible for those 3 points. In other words, there's an irony in here that the church committed itself uncritically to a world which it helped create well. Now, what I'm referring to there can be controversial discussion. I don't want to get into any great depth, but I mean simply things like the Christian contribution of vocation to the work ethic and things like that. You know, as well as much more looser things like a Christian view of humanness and so on. But particularly, I'll look at that in a later session, the Christian contribution of vocation, which gave a terrific dynamic to the whole work and the rise of much of the modern world. But we'll look at that in more detail later. I know it's...
Well, then, if I can ask the consequent question, are these things that you've spoken of, in particular, these pressures, are they intrinsically alien to the expression of and the nature of the Christian faith, or can they somehow or other be subsumed into it and exploited to the advantage of Christianity?
Pluralization is clearly not alien. In other words, in a fallen world, we expect that everyone who doesn't bow before God will be different to some extent and take us on. You know, so that is built into the essence of the fallen world, and the early church was never fazed by it, but you can look from modern theology onwards. You know, terrific impact today of that one. Secularization, I think, is inherently a challenge. And because it's so new, well, in a way I'm hinting at what I'm moving at later on, this question. Could we leave some of these till later?
Yeah.
In other words, both the others are unnecessary. Privatization is unnecessary, and so is secularization. Pluralization, I think, in a fallen world is absolutely inevitable. We'll never transcend it. Put it another way, our faithfulness means that we will make Christ Lord of everything we have and are and do and so on, which should wipe out secularization and which will wipe out privatization for the Christian. But of course that will never deal with pluralization, because there will be many others who haven't exercised the lordship. But we'll move on to this as we go down.
When you talk about it later, you're going to talk about how the Christian individual and community should handle a world which is secularized.
Uh-huh.
Change it or infiltrate it?
Well, let me put just very simply at this stage. I think the basic thrust is faithfulness expressed individually. In other words, the problem at the moment is not we don't have Christians where they should be, but the Christians who are where they should be aren't Christian where they are. In other words, I'm not calling for a movement to whatever. I'm just saying we need to encourage the Christian teachers in the school to know how to think, act, teach Christianly where she is. Christian member of parliament or the Christian doctor, to be the consistent disciple where they are. That's the basic thrust of what I'm saying. So, as you'll see, I'm not calling for any movement, crusade, or social this, or collective that, or whatever, but rather a dynamic that penetrates society, because each individual disciple knows what it means to make Christ Lord of everything they are, wherever they are. But this will become clear as we go on.
Yeah.
No, wait, let me, you're misleading me in a way, because I haven't called for anything so far. These questions are pointing forward. Let's drop everything that points forward. Let's limit the discussion, if we can, to analysis at this point. Okay? Yeah.
I'm hearing you say, let's get beyond renewal to reformation. Are you there talking about reforming us as a Christian people who think Christianly and develop a Christian culture, or are you talking about
what does the scripture mean by it? Well, let me put it very simply. I don't want to go, again, you're pushing me forward again. I don't want to go forward at this stage. You want to make sure you've got what I'm on about here. Don't duck this one first. By reformation, I do not mean re-Christianization. Let me be quite clear about that. In other words, there's no attempt to save the West, or recapture culture for Christ, or something sort of magnificent like that. The concern is just faithfulness. Culture is always, even civilization, is a byproduct of God's grace of faithfulness. So, God alone knows what happens when we're faithful. The key thing is we've got to recover the full dimensions of obedience and faithfulness today. And we'll leave with him the results in the arts or politics or whatever, even for the West. I'm not concerned about Western civilization. But it's just simply faithfulness to Christ. And surely the biblical position is, whenever and wherever we are more shaped by the world, well, the words of Paul, be not conformed. If it's ideas, or is it structures, is it my family, is it my economics, is it my psychology, is it, you know, am I more English and white and middle class and whatever than I am Christian, then I've got to change and to be reformed by the, transformed by the renewing of my mind. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, not re-Christianization. Don't push me forward anymore. This, yeah.
I want to go back to history, but I'm wondering if are you overstating the case?
At which point? I've certainly oversimplified a lot. Press me to be more accurate if you want.
The point of the danger is so great today as against previous history. I'm trying to think of the 4th century when the church went from being the persecuted church in the Roman Empire to being the official church of the secular state, with the influx of pagans into the church for all the wrong reasons. And I'm wondering how our modern-day situation compares in reality to that 4th century.
Sure. 16th century, many periods, or 6th century, desperate low points, spiritually speaking. But you see, part of the difference of today is that it's the structural shape. So this is not a matter of statistics. For instance, in Britain, our church going is way down below 10%. You're much better off in Australia than we are. But what I'm saying is not just a matter of the poor British situation so spiritually low. It's true of the Americans. You can go to parts of the Midwest of the States where church going is 75%. Considering their numbers in today, oh, let me put it like this. There have never been more Christians than there are in America today. They have never had, well, they could have had more spiritual renewal, but they've got an amazing movement of spiritual renewal. They've never had more money, they've never had higher positions of influence, and they've never had more powerful organs of communication. One in three Americans claims to be born again, yet America goes on much the same as before. See, here's the difference. In the past, so often, in other words, I'm not really comparing. God only knows, ultimately. Many people are making this comment. But in the past, when Christians got down to a minority and the church became dead, all you needed was the movement of the Spirit and the Word to revive them or recover them, as it were, and they got back on with it because they had the freedom to do so. Today, many Christians, the problem is that they think they're renewed, revived, reformed, evangelical, orthodox, use any name you like to whatever that's good, and yet despite all that, they can't see how desperately seriously they're being shaped. That's why this is a kind of structural equivalent of Gnosticism, rather than just a period, a cycle of rise and decline. But I ultimately don't want to say which is the worst, God only knows. But you see the slight difference of ours, that we have so much, and yet where it really matters, we are profoundly deficient. That's the point I'm making. Yeah.
Just the question about the church as a whole, and I just feel that there's a real question mark there, because I think it's okay to say that people need to change individually and reassess where they're at and where society is at, but you get individuals who are out in the cold, so to speak, because they have no real grouping of people that are bound together under the Lordship of Christ, but who are really standing firm.
Absolutely.
So how do you answer to the church and its thrust into the world, or how it's standing within itself?
I'm not advocating individualism, don't misunderstand me. But I'm saying that the single greatest difference, or the sort of things we're talking about now, would come from the recovery of vocation and the Lordship of Christ, so that there are millions of Christian individuals out there. As I say, the problem is not really that they aren't where they should be, but they're not what they should be where they are. Now, that won't be individualistic, because they need to come from congregations, from communities, from core groups that really support, stimulate, and so on. No one can go it alone, and we'll come to that too. And I certainly don't want to be individualistic.
My question is whether they should be in those places that you are talking about. The nature of to what degree they should be.
You mean Christians shouldn't be doctors and lawyers and teachers?
No, I'm not saying that.
Those are the people I'm talking about.
Yes, I know, but I'm saying that maybe because of this whole vast technology and the whole idea of variety of jobs, etc., that people possibly aren't in places where really they shouldn't be.
Oh, I agree with that too. Now, let's leave that particular one for tonight, because we look at work and this whole area. Leave that one for tonight, because that's exactly on this topic.
Yeah, but I'm getting to a point here
But you're pressing me forward to solutions again, whereas I really...
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm just questioning your understanding there, where you say that it's okay for people to be out there. I think that really needs to be looked at more...
Okay, all right.
...more critically.
Okay, well, we'll do that tonight. For the moment, let's just look at the pressures against us. Okay, but fair game. You challenge that one tonight.
The pressure of time. You mentioned that sort of stuck in my mind, the scheduling of life. The young man, the young woman, as a committed Christian, Christian growing into today's world and having an effective role, is it possible in real discipleship to break the bind of the time pressure and studies and all the other things to be more effective in their walk with Christ? How do they break that bind of time?
That's actually the very heart of what we're looking at tonight, the question of how. But let me just raise one simple point here. To this point, all I'm concerned with is the sort of mentality of time, the time consciousness. You know, and I would just say, there's nothing wrong with being modern, you know, being punctual and realizing how much of the modern world has to work. The question is how much other things that squeezes out. For instance, it's pointed out by studies, who often are the people who introduce secularization to the third world? I've given it away. Missionaries. Why? Because Western missionaries, actually, in practice, where is their supernatural world? The only really practical part of it left is prayer, a sort of thin pipeline to God. They don't have any living world of the invisible, supernatural, whatever, because Western consciousness doesn't. We've emptied out angels as unrealities and evil things to unreality to many people. It's a sort of empty universe apart from God and prayer. Theoretically, angels or whatever. And so, in fact, most Christian consciousness is about as secularized as the atheist, except we have prayer and this pipeline to God. That's about it. Now, there's all sorts of examples where really, in many ways, we're not as biblical as we think, and we've lost the richness of dimensions that we should have. Now, the question you raised, how in the tyranny of time do we keep from being pulled in 100 ways, I'll deal with tonight. That's a very important one, too. Sorry? The intriguing thing is, if you look at the world, secular people are on the increase. The number of secular people in the world is the biggest shift in the 20th century. They have grown from 0.2%, a fifth of 1%, to 21.3%, which is one-fifth of the world. From one-fifth of 1% to one-fifth of the world. Either happy-go-lucky people who don't believe anything and hardly realize it, up to militant Marxist KGB people, you know, includes the whole lot. Now, the interesting thing is that at this very moment, secularists, in the philosophical sense, are actually not doing too well. Now, the reason I said that was because the American fundamentalist thinks there's a secularist conspiracy, whereas in many ways the problem is not secularism, it's not doing all that well in the States. It's that the church itself has been secularized and much of America has been. Now, what you see in the moral majority and so on is the fact that in the old days, you know, they could separate church and state because underlying the church-state separation, there was a general consensus of broadly accepted Christian principles and so on, mixed in with certain Enlightenment principles, which held the thing together. But then first, there was a flooding of new immigrants that were non-Protestant first and then non-Christian. Then secularization, secularism on top of that, in other words, the basis have gone. So they separated church-state separation in a secular context rather than an original Protestant one. So suddenly the whole Christian binding disappears. And Christians who for decades have been pietists and not particularly active at all, fundamentalists, have been appallingly inactive. They're the least politically conscious group in the whole of the States. Suddenly they begin to realize the logic of their inactivism, and they've shot out of a pietistic inactivism into a highly activist but rather uncritical stance. And then you can see the problems they've developed. In other words, I would not quarrel that they should be out there, but they should be out there more critically and Christianly than they are. And they've done things like just equate Christian principles and conservative politics, confuse them. They've done a whole number of mistakes like that. And that is what's led to the extremes. Now, I don't dispute their right to be out there, but they should be out there more Christianly than they are. And one must equally say, there are people on the left doing the same things. You can read some of the Christian press in America, the so-called radical Christian press. It's just a reflection of the liberal left intelligentsia, uncritically, from the left side. You go down further south in Latin America, and if you've got sort of conservative politics and conservative religion goes together pretty handily in North America, further south you go, you see that the equation's the opposite down there. But you see, each of these is merely a reflection of the culture rather than a highly critical Christian involvement in the public. So that's the problem with those sorts of things. But thank God that they care and they're doing something. And thank God that the other activists care and are doing something. But we must each challenge each other to be critical and Christian and biblical about what we do when we go out. Let's leave it there.